Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. In this first hour of the show today, we will look at a growing trend in the practice of modern warfare, and that is the use of private soldiers. Our guest for this hour, Robert Young Pelton, spent several years traveling around the globe talking with some of the people who do this work, trying to understand why and what's involved. And has written a book about this. It's, in fact, not quite out officially. It will be published at the beginning of September, and I'm sure that you will be able to find it wherever you go and buy books. His book is titled License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and it's published by Crown Publishers. And in the book, he makes the argument that the commercial provision of armed force has not only become a standard way of doing business around the world, it's also become a supplemental tool of foreign policy. And there are some dangers that certainly attach to that. As we talk here in this hour of the show with our guest, Robert Young Pelton, you're certainly welcome to call in with questions. We just ask people who are calling in, please be brief. Remember, you're sharing the space with other callers, and we'd like to get in as many people as we can. The number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Our guest, Robert Young Pelton, is writer, filmmaker, and explorer. He is the author of four works of nonfiction, including the bestseller World's Most Dangerous Places. He's contributing editor and columnist for National Geographic Explorer, for National Geographic Adventure, and he is also currently producing a documentary on this topic on security contractors for National Geographic Explorer, titled Working in the Kill Zone. He's also worked as a journalist for CNN, for CBS's program 60 Minutes, for ABC's Investigative Unit, and also for National Geographic. And he is joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Pelton, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. I think that some people, to begin here, some people will recognize the name Blackwater.
I'm sorry, Dad. I'm hearing loud music being played.
How about now?
That's great.
Okay. Sorry. So I guess we had a couple wires crossed. Anyway, welcome to the show. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
For being with us. People, I think, well, some people at least, if they've been following closely the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, will recognize the name Blackwater,
mm-hmm.
as you explain, one of the world's most successful providers of security trainers and armed men. They have people in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in New Orleans. And you had the opportunity to meet and talk with the man who started Blackwater. And this is not a guy who does a lot of interviews, but he talked to you. He's a former Navy SEAL. His name is Eric Prince. How did you happen to meet him and convince him that it would be a good thing for him to spend some time talking with you?
Well, I think a lot of people know who I am through my book, The World's Most Dangerous Places, and particularly if you're in the military or in special operations, is sort of a must-read. So I guess I was a bit of a rock star, I mean, to put it kind of humorously. And I actually spent a month working with these people. I wasn't obviously doing what they do, but I slept, ate, got up every day, did the airport road for a month during its most violent period. So I guess I'd earned my spurs, if you want to call it that. Plus, I think he also wanted to talk to me because he felt I would understand. I wouldn't say he's reclusive, but he's the kind of person who, if you listen to what he says, you can definitely take it out of context and turn it around into a negative. So I think it was trusting of me, and that's why I got the access.
He certainly has, his company has been made, his fortune has been made, I think it's fair to say, by the war on terror.
Yes.
He was hired when he was just getting his company off the ground. He was hired to put people into Afghanistan, and the company certainly has grown in a relatively short period of time. Why do you think he and his company have been so successful?
Well, if you remember on September 12th, George Bush sat down with the CIA and with Tommy Franks and said, what are we going to do? Well, Tommy Franks wanted to run tanks up the Khyber Pass, but it needed 6 months to a year to do that. Tenet said, we can get people on the ground within a very short period of time. Unfortunately, they didn't have the staff for that, so they had to bring people out of retirement. They had to bring in contractors and freelancers, and they even ran out of the old boys' network. So Eric Prince, because one of his employees actually used to work for the CIA, said, you know, they're really hurting for people over there. Why don't you go over there, and we can provide basically an old boys network. In other words, a list of people that we know from SEAL teams and whatever. And they were hired on a contract on a no-bid, urgent and compelling basis by Buzzy Krongard, essentially to guard the CIA station in Kabul and down at Shkin, which was a forward operating base for the CIA, and out in Herat. And that's sort of the beginning of Blackwater. And then when Iraq hit, they had to keep Paul Bremer alive, and there was no other way to do it other than hire private forces to do that, including an aviation component, you name it. So right now there's about 70,000 private contractors working in Iraq, and about half of those are Iraqi, but it's a huge, huge development.
Well, part of what they were doing, part of what you describe, could fall under the headline, the heading of security. That is, they were providing security. They were guarding people just as they continued to, these kinds of people continue to provide security for Hamid Karzai, for example, the president of Afghanistan. So in one sense, a security contractor, that kind of label would fit. Are they also doing fighting and essentially doing the work that soldiers would be doing?
No, and this is an interesting line, because my book covers mercenaries, assassins, security contractors. They're all private contractors. They all work for various people. But, for example, Jean-Bertrand Aristide originally was given a personal security detail made up of, you know, special forces and Americans who were to keep him alive. When he fell out of favor with the U.S. government, it was actually his own private security detail that was told to wake him up and take him to the airport, where he was met by an anonymous group of U.S. military types who immediately deposed him and flew him to Africa. Karzai was kept alive specifically by a private company called DynCorp, who put together a group of, you know, tier one type people to keep him alive. But had Hamid Karzai decided that he didn't like America or wasn't going to follow our notebook, that same group could have deposed them in a second. So it's a fascinating double-edged sword. In the last chapter in the book, I talk about the coup in Equatorial Guinea, where a group of mercenaries, some of them private contractors working in Iraq, tried to depose the leader of a very oil-rich nation. And one of the things they demanded was that they would be his private security detail. You can see how it can be used both ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can use a lot of different words to describe these people and what they do, and two of them, one might be mercenary and the other is something that's more of a euphemism when you talk about security contractors. And the implications, the connotations of those two words, they are very different. Well, is there in fact a difference between a mercenary and security contractor?
I guess absolutely. I mean, a mercenary is a legal term. It's also a pejorative term, but essentially a mercenary is somebody who fights in combat, and that means getting up in the morning and killing people. A security contractor is not allowed to do that. He has what they call rules of engagement. That doesn't mean he can't provide lethal force, but he doesn't get up in the morning and say, I'm going to go kill these people. Now, I have met people in Iraq that do that. There are private security contractors who, what they call, go over the wall or off the reservation and go take out members of the insurgency, or actually work with the U.S. military on an ad hoc sort of off-the-record basis because they have certain skills. But these people are not supposed to be doing that. They're supposed to be providing defensive sort of threat. And that means if you're driving down the road with a private security detail and you are attacked by insurgents, let's say, if you're with a private company, you can return fire, but you can't stay there and engage the enemy for a long period of time. You have to get off the X, as they call it. If you're the U.S. military, obviously you're going to call in reinforcements and you're going to continue the engagement until the enemy breaks contact or is dead.
Well, that, I guess, that does get at the question or point of the question about where the line is and about just how clear are rules of engagement and how different they are between security contractors and the military, and whether people respect that line. And, you know, just generally speaking, what are the rules that apply to the conduct of these kind of people, and do they indeed follow the rules?
Here's how it works. Most of these people are ex-military. That means we've invested, you know, 5, 10, 15 years of training in these men. And they're the same men, whether they take their uniform off or not. They go to work for a private firm. They are told to protect an object, a person, or a place. They do that. They follow rules of engagement. But sometimes when they're engaged in a violent event, they have to fire back. Now, it's up to the individual or that team how aggressive they are in firing back. There was an incident in Najaf in which the only people holding off in sort of an Alamo-type event were private contractors from Blackwater who were firing at the Mahdi Army and being resupplied by Blackwater helicopters. They are essentially a fighting force at that moment in time. There are also other groups in which there have been serious problems with violence dealt out to Iraqi citizens. You probably saw the Aegis video in which you saw sort of faceless, nameless people pounding away at cars that were following too close or, you know, coming up on them quickly. And there have been a number of incidents that I've investigated in which Iraqis have been gunned down, run over, shot, injured, wounded by security details. The catch is that they are immune from prosecution. When Paul Bremer went to Iraq to be the viceroy, he essentially issued a memorandum saying that no American contractor is liable for prosecution under Iraqi law. When it was handed over to the government, the Ministry of the Interior in Iraq is supposed to register and control these companies. The problem is they don't, and they have no way to do it, and they have no interest in doing it. So essentially, they're operating with a license to kill.
Another question, this is something that certainly has been written about, that we have individuals who are in the military who are highly skilled to do a particular kind of job. They're highly trained. We, as taxpayers, have invested a lot in them, and they have found that they can actually make a better living by leaving the military and going to work for private contractors. And so not only are we losing the kind of people we really need, but we're never really going to be able to recoup the investment we've made in them because we have trained them and now they've gone off to work for somebody like Blackwater. That I know that that actually happens. Are we talking about a lot of people here, and does that have some sort of serious consequence, do you think, for the quality of the American military?
This is an interesting question because when I was first in the war after September 11th in Afghanistan, I was with a team of special operations soldiers, what they call Green Berets, fighting with General Dostum. Within 6 months of that event, two of them were working as private contractors. In the Army, they were making the equivalent of about, you know, $60,000 to $80,000 a year plus housing and benefits. As a private military contractor on a 2-6-month contract guarding Hamid Karzai, they were making $600 a day. Solid for 1 year. So the appeal is great. Second of all, what exactly does a special operations soldier do once he gets out of the military? If you're a weapons specialist and you know how to fire every kind of weapon, detonate every kind of explosives, the joke that circulates is that basically you can be a greeter at Walmart. So there really is no sort of high-end capability or job market for these people. Thirdly, our government's not dumb. They essentially recycle these people, and they hire them back to do things, whether it's within the CIA or within sort of the contractor industry, to do the things they couldn't ask the military to do. And that's where my book kind of focuses.
So it's so if you'd ask this question to somebody at the Pentagon, you'd say to them, well, look, wouldn't it be a little bit more cost effective if somehow we couldn't find a way to hold on to these people? And if they were being candid with you, they might say, well, yes, but also it is possible that we, in by doing this, by employing them as private contractors, we can actually have them do things that we cannot have our own soldiers do.
Exactly. And my opening chapter is called Kill Them All. It's about a 74-year-old gentleman named Billy Waugh, the world's oldest operating CIA paramilitary, who actually signed up in World War II and ended up being a special forces soldier in the 50s and then a covert operator for the CIA, then a professional assassin, and actually tracked bin Laden in Sudan under Kofor Black, originally to be an assassin, ended up just being a surveillance job, ends up back in Afghanistan after September 11th because the CIA didn't have capability. So he had to hire about 64 people, both what they call sheep dipping, which is where you take an active soldier and pretend like he's doing one thing, but he's actually working for the CIA, and also the old boys network, which is basically retired special operations people who go into a combat role. And he is sort of my keel to show you that we used to do this in the dirty wars in Laos. You remember the film Apocalypse Now, where Willard goes upstream to kill Kurds. Back in the days of Air America and a lot of strange and weird things that were never talked about, it was done by contractors. And that has come back. We shut it down with the Church Pike Commission, but it's back.
Well, this, as you point out, it was certainly true that we have done this back, going back to Vietnam, we did this. Is is what's happening now somehow fundamentally different, or is it essentially the same, just that perhaps there are more of these kind of people?
Yes, it's a huge, huge market that didn't exist before. In other words, yes, you do have the covert operators who are working as contractors for intelligence agencies and for private corporations aligned with U.S. government interests. But you also have this larger group of basically security guards. They're people that go over there. I was in Iraq last month, and I was with a group of guys with armored cars and machine guns, and we were guarding gravel that was going to build a police station, and they were attacked every night. And it's a very mundane job. If you remember the Fallujah incident in which four people were killed and burned and strung up, they were guarding kitchen equipment. And at the time of their deaths, they were guarding empty trucks. So it runs from the sort of obscure and curious to the mundane and obvious.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Robert Young Pelton. His book, which is due out right at the beginning of September, is License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror. It's published by Crown. It looks at a growing trend in the practice of modern warfare, that is the use of private soldiers. Robert Young Pelton is a writer, filmmaker, explorer. He has worked for National Geographic and, in fact, is working on a documentary on this very subject for National Geographic Explorer. He's also worked for CNN, for CBS, for ABC, and National Geographic. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You have now had the opportunity to spend some time and get to know some of the people who do this kind of work, and if you ask the question, why do you do it? Obviously, as you've discussed, perhaps one reason they do it is it's a good job and it pays well, even though it's very dangerous. Is that for them the bottom line, that it is they have the skills, they have the training, there's no place else they can do it, and they can make a good living doing it, assuming that they stay alive? Is that really the bottom line reason?
No, it's a tribal thing, and I've been with various groups of armed people, whether they're jihadis or rebels or mercenaries or whatever. What you find is that someone who is good at military skills, you know, does his time, gets out, gets a mundane job, and is faced with the realities of sort of a peaceful world, and wants to get back into it. And they have basically three driving forces. One is obviously money, because almost everybody I've met in this field had some kind of financial setback, whether it's debt, divorce, or something like that. Second thing is they want to feel like they're doing something useful. And the third thing is the camaraderie. They like to work with like-minded individuals. And it is now a profession, and people go back and forth all the time between Iraq and here and Afghanistan and here. And it has become sort of a respected profession.
Well, and I wonder, in fact, to what extent they are political, or whether they're political at all. Do they think about the political implications of what they do, or is it just basically a job?
Well, overwhelmingly, these people are from the South. They tend to be from low-income or rural families. They tend to be right-wing. They support the Bush doctrine of Reconstruction, and they see themselves as an integral part of that entire process. I have met some intellectuals who almost overwhelmingly do one or two tours and say, okay, that's it, I'm done, because they don't want to die for something as mundane as an IED that was placed randomly by some kid. They see the lack of purpose in terms of dying in a conflict that has no clear end or focus.
Just one more question, and I have some callers here I want to get to. You made a reference to the Blackwater employees that were killed in Fallujah in March of 2004. People probably will remember that. The family has been trying to take Blackwater to court now for some time. Their argument is that Blackwater didn't do enough to protect the lives of their family members, and they should be held accountable. And now a federal appeals court, has ruled that a wrongful death lawsuit that's been filed against Blackwater can go ahead in state court in North Carolina. Do you think that really opens up the possibility that the employers of these people would be, in a sense, be held to a higher standard of safety for their people? And in fact, do the people who do the work, do they think that their employers are taking enough care when it comes to their own safety and security?
Well, here's the conundrum, because under the LOGCAP agreement, which is what the whole idea of privatized support of the military is based on, something that Dick Cheney and Rutan Brown came up with after the Soviet collapse, the idea that contractors in the battlefield are supposed to be protected by the military. They're not supposed to wear uniforms or weapons or whatever. But because they found a back door, you can subcontract this centralized deal that Halliburton has, and that's what Blackwater was working on. Each company has to provide their own security, and obviously because then it's a profit-making decision, a lot of people took shortcuts. And in my opinion, at that time, Blackwater was eager to get into the market. It was hard to get armored cars. The choice was, do we just provide security at a lesser level and wait, I mean, for this stuff, or do we just wait till we have everything and do it? Some serious mistakes were made, both on the operator side and also on the corporate side. Blackwater also has another lawsuit in which one of their planes crashed in Afghanistan, killing some military people, and those families are suing because it's a civilian company. Blackwater maintains that, well, no, we're working for the U.S. government, therefore we can't be sued. But when you privatize essentially combat and operations in support of the military, you now open a huge Pandora's box of legalities and who's responsible for what.
We have several callers here. We're already at our midpoint. Again, callers will really help us by being brief in their comments so we can get in as many other folks as possible. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We'll start with our first caller, line one in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Yes, one of your first comments was that one of the incentives for using contractors is that it allows the government to do things which it could not do with its own men. Isn't it a more accurate statement that this allows the government to break the law and do criminal things?
To answer your question very specifically, I can hire a corporation to do something in a foreign country, and they can hire foreign nationals to do things that are okay under their law. For example, the entire CIA program of rendition abuses this idea. But it allows us to project foreign policy and also to deny it. And it is, yes, it is a very, very dangerous way for the executive office to carry out their own brand of foreign policy without running it by the voters. So, yes, I think it's a very dangerous development, and yes, it does allow them to break our law.
It has been suggested that by President Bush's doctrine, he could essentially, if he declares the nation in jeopardy, reestablish slavery or virtually any other thing.
Well, I think at some point there's pushback. I'm just saying that right now, because of the lack of capability, because of what they call the all-volunteer military, in order for him to affect his global policy, he relies more and more on the private sector, but we as voters have very little say in which companies are hired and also whether this phenomena is good or bad because of the lack of accountability, lack of transparency, lack of public awareness.
One of the major features of this policy has been the redefinition of torture.
Correct.
Which is unlawful by international law and by American law. And if you look carefully at the history of the CIA's use of torture, you find it has been disastrous.
I'll comment on one thing. David Pissarro was recently convicted. He's a CIA contractor of beating to death an Afghan who was found to be innocent. In other words, this fellow they were looking for him. He gave himself up. He was beaten until he died, and then he was charged with a crime. Now, that is the only incident that I know. In Iraq, for example, when I was on the road with the contractors, we shot at people all the time, and there were casualties. And the point is that not one single contractor in Iraq has been charged with causing a fatality or, you know, causing damage to Iraqi citizens. So it is deliberately so. It was set up by that way by Paul Bremer, who worked for George Bush, and it continues to be that way.
Yes, and you're not suggesting that none have injured Iraqi.
I'm telling you for a fact that
there has been no retribution.
Right. I know for a fact that dozens, if not hundreds, of Iraqis have been gunned down by contractors who have the ability to use lethal force, but no contractor or company has been brought to task for causing unnecessary death.
The claim of the expediency of torture, which is often carried out under this type of program, has been the case in the Philippines, where it was discovered that a group were planning to bring down airplanes. The Philippine equivalent of the CIA seized the person the police had captured after a few days and proceeded to torture him. They then claimed that they had prevented the attack on the airplanes, but it turns out that really what happened was the police did some pretty good work, and they found his laptop, and all of the important information was found within the first hour on that laptop.
Right, that's Ramzi Youssef you're talking about.
The secret police actually found almost nothing with their, I believe it was 60 days of concentrated torture.
Right, but you'll find that countries like Jordan, Egypt, Uzbekistan are horrendous in terms of their use of torture on their own subjects, and we routinely ship people we capture to these countries for interrogation, you know, quotation marks, by these countries, because if we did it, the people would go to jail. So it's outsourcing torture. The planes that are used to take these people to these places are all owned by private corporations, some of them owned by the CIA, some of them owned by investors. So the point is that when you privatize things, you create a very high wall. And if you ask questions about, well, what are these people doing, where are they going, you don't get any answers because they'll say, I can't talk about it because in my contract, I will be fined if I tell you what I'm doing there. So if there are 100 people and 99 of them are doing good things and 1% is doing bad things, you'll never know the difference.
You said that you know for a fact that Iraqis have been killed by private contractors.
Correct.
Has the government of Iraq not said anything about this?
To me, it's fascinating because the Ministry of the Interior is in charge for controlling privatized security over there. There are accusations, and I believe that I have proof, that the Ministry of the Interior actually operates death squads under the guise of private security contractors. So it is in their interest not to pursue any allegations of violence or criminality within the privatized military sector. And once again, it doesn't mean that everybody's running rampant. It just means that that use of lethal force under the private label is used by businessmen to intimidate competition. For example, an Arachna cell phone provider had 50 of their security people kidnapped and taken away by the Ministry of the Interior. They use this line, well, they stole police uniforms and they pretended they were police. Well, that's not true. They were the police. There are massive infiltrations of militias within the Ministry of the Interior forces, many of whom work as private security contractors. So it's a mess.
We're a little past the midpoint here. Let me just quickly introduce again the guest, Robert Young Pelton. He's a writer, filmmaker, explorer. He's the author of four works of nonfiction, including the bestseller World's Most Dangerous Places. He's a contributing editor and columnist for National Geographic Adventure. He's working on a documentary now about security contractors for National Geographic Explorer. He's worked as a journalist for CNN, for CBS, 60 Minutes, for ABC's Investigative Unit, and for National Geographic. And if you are interested in reading a book on the subject, he has written one that's not quite out yet. It will be out in the beginning of September, Licensed to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and it's published by Crown. Let's go to another caller here, Champaign County, Line 3. Hello.
Good morning. You said you can't tell whether it's good or bad because it's not transparent, and I'm paraphrasing you. Well, I would submit that that's exactly why you can say it's prima facie bad, because there isn't any oversight. I'm not saying that everything that the U.S. done through the world should be public, but there should be some oversight by the Congress. I would prefer that it would be entirely transparent and that we would know. People in Illinois can look to Jan Schakowsky in Evanston. She's a leading congressional critic of private military contractors, and she's basically underscoring that idea that the Congress doesn't have oversight, and these groups have strong connections to the Bush administration. Actually, when Kofor Black, who's with Blackwater now, got in trouble with Rumsfeld, they found him a job with Blackwater, basically. They kicked him out of the he probably made more money, too, I suppose. But that's just the editorial. I wanted to ask you, Schakowsky is particularly concerned about the use of mercenaries in Colombia, where they've been haggling over whether there's 600 or 800 or this kind of thing. It's the third largest, I guess, use. I don't know if you've studied that as well. There's another interesting Latin American connection, which is that 3D Global Solutions, Triple Canopy, MVM, and Deflon, the latter one has moved 1,200 Peruvians to the U.S. Embassy in the Green Zone area.
Sure.
So this was written by Isabel Ordonez, and you can find it on Alternet, but I think the Daily Scotsman is the only other regular paper that seems to have picked up the story, even though it's pretty amazing. So that's a lot. I've been looking at this issue for quite a while. I'm obviously very opposed to it.
What's your name?
Well, I usually go by Champaign County. I'm Paul.
We generally don't ask people their names.
I was going to respond to him by his name. But
there's a provision. There's this idea that there's some anonymity here, but regular callers don't have any. So
that's fine. In any case, I was going to address some of your concerns because you're obviously very well read on this. I know Colombia very well. I know the leaders of the paramilitaries, which is essentially a private military arm. I know the leaders of the FARC, and I also know some of the groups that work down there as private contractors. That is basically the future of where we're going, where the government is too weak, so they outsource all the provision of security and also the provision of violence to outside players, non-state players. Yes, your representative should be very worried because in an industry that has exploded since 9/11, there is absolutely no transparency. There is no accountability. You cannot, as a taxpayer, figure out what these guys are doing, and yet they travel around Iraq using lethal force for good and for bad. I'm encouraging everyone, if you saw how George Bush responded when a young lady asked him about who are these private contractors and what are they doing over there, he said, that's a good question. Well, that should be a red flag to Congress to get these CEOs and these people in front of them and say, what are you doing over there? What are you doing with our money? And are you doing good things, bad things, or whatever? I believe the industry is good. I believe that once you sort out the people who are doing bad things, people will get a better understanding of this industry. But both you and I have the same concerns that if 10 people are operating with my tax dollars and I'm hearing about dead Iraqis and violence and other things like that, who's doing that? Well, I don't know.
Well, if you say that it's good, you say that it needs, what kind of remedy are you suggesting? I know there's been some haggling about a law that gives some provision for a judicial process. Now, the Iraqis have been saying that these people are not American military and that they should be...
They're mercenaries. That's what they
say. They should be treated as people who are in the country and should be under the provision of Iraqi law.
Let me give you an exact example. There's a fellow named Tim Spicer. Tim Spicer is a very famous mercenary. He used to run a company called Sandline, which was hired by industrialists to overthrow governments, and the background for that was that they wanted access to either diamonds or mines or industrial wealth. He then stopped that because he couldn't make any money at it. He is now the person who is the recipient of the largest single security contract in Iraq. He went from being a mercenary to being a very affluent provider of security for our government. In other words, he coordinates all the security firms. He is the guy that provides the intelligence. And somehow this company, which had basically one or two employees and was just a startup, was handed a $500 million contract, and this fellow's a mercenary. When the Irish senators brought up that this guy was involved in a very dark and dubious event in Northern Ireland, nothing happened. And when people said, well, what's this video? There's a video on the Internet called the Aegis video showing people shooting at Iraqis. He did a study, and it was immediately submerged by the U.S. government, his client, the Department of Defense. So that's what I'm talking about, the lack of accountability. And yet Tim Spicer goes around making speeches demanding accountability and transparency. That's the hypocrisy of the whole thing.
Well, let's go to another caller. This is someone in Savoy, nearby community, line two. Hello.
Yeah, this is an interesting discussion here. You know, it's very common for the American government to hire very strong outside forces, and it goes all the way back to the Revolution and the War of 1812 with the letters of marque and so on and so forth, where you'd hire privateers and everything else that you could lay your hands on to go out and protect yourself or to exercise foreign policy. And another, one of the most famous private operations in history was the Flying Tigers in 1940. They were operating in China, shooting down Japanese aircraft 2 years before we got into the war. And it's one of the few businesses that actually was on budget and destroyed more Japanese aircraft than was spent on the entire operation before it was absorbed into the, I forget which Air Force it was, but finally in 1942 they were absorbed into the Army Air Force.
Well, it's funny because it sounds like you're reading from the Blackwater PowerPoint presentation.
Well, yeah, but no, I just happened, I happen to understand a little bit of history.
Right, it goes back to
Lafayette. And it goes way back, man.
Right, in other words, during the Revolutionary War, we had militias and we needed training, so we reached out to people like von Steuben and Lafayette
right.
to give us skills. And you're absolutely right that Eric Prince, the owner of Blackwater, uses those exact names and the CAMCO and the whole idea of privatizing warfare in his provision of what he calls relief with teeth or a 1,700-man army that's ready to go at a moment's notice.
Well, some of these people, obviously, there's some really unsavory characters out there, and you definitely want control over who you've hired.
Exactly.
And
unless you don't want control or transparency, which is what our government also...
Right. Well, I don't know. I've read the history of the Flying Tigers and everything like that, and actually that was a very transparent operation. Everybody, in fact, it was widely, once they got going, they were very successful.
Correct. But
and the minute they became successful, hey, it was a PR thing. It actually hit the papers. And even the British government went and there at Rangoon, they went and they decorated several of the pilots in the defense of Rangoon. Mm-hmm. And the American government, they couldn't do anything because they weren't official. They weren't they couldn't say, well, gee, they're acting on the American government's part.
Right. And that's what I try to point out, that there's a huge world out there of what they call proxy armies, like the Sandinistas or the Northern Alliance. There are mercenaries, like the people who tried to overthrow Equatorial Guinea. There are contractors who work in Iraq. But the unfortunate thing is that these people shift over. In other words, there are actually two fellows in Iraq who were working as private security contractors. They told their boss they were going to go buffalo hunting. They ended up on a plane trying to overthrow the government of Equatorial Guinea. It's the exact same skill set. And it's the same sort of tribal network.
Yeah. Well, you gotta keep control of them, and you gotta have some transparency, and somebody's got to have some common sense whenever they, make sure that they don't get out of hand.
Correct.
But we've used them since the revolution.
Exactly.
Well, just for a second, I'd like to have you talk a little bit more about this idea that Eric Prince, the CEO of Blackwater, has laid out there, that he's saying that not only could I provide to you, that is whoever's willing to pay the bill, some security detail to protect your foreign leader or to do whatever, I can provide you with what is essentially a small army,
right.
Not just men who are have light weapons and know how to use them, but I'm talking about soldiers and armor and air support and artillery and the whole deal.
Right.
Is this something that he actually is in position to do, or he's saying that he's sort of pitching that as an idea, or that he's ready to go with that now?
Oh, he's ready to go. He also has fabricated a gunship, which is a Kaza 212 with two cannons that fire, I don't know how many rounds per second. He has a Embraer fighter bomber, which he doesn't actually sell the bombs for, but you can link them onto the hard points. He has armored vehicles. He has people with skill sets. He has an intelligence division. But I have to say one thing, that he always is talking about in support of the U.S. In other words, he is not about to go to some banana republic and say, here's the bill. That's what companies like EO and Sandline did. They went to dictators or countries that were having problems, and they said, here's what it costs to get your country back in shape. So whether it was Angola or Sierra Leone or Papua New Guinea, and that's where it starts getting strange, because in Equatorial Guinea about 2 years ago, the same group that basically made up Sandline decided, well, we don't need to wait for government contracts. We'll just fund ourselves and go overthrow a country. And that's the most weird. That's the weirdest permutation of that concept.
Well, and I guess I would go back to, I'm sure people like our previous caller would say something like, well, there also have always been people like that. And you know, people who were soldiers for hire, who had little armies, who said either I'm willing to come and fight in your country for the bill. I mean, or maybe there weren't people who said, "Well, shoot first and see how things shake out later." But again, I guess it gets us back to this question of are we at some point here that is fundamentally different?
Yes.
Than we have been before.
I suggest that the caller go to Iraq and try driving around Baghdad for one day, and you will see these convoys of tinted window SUVs with guns poking out, driving at high speeds with weapons firing at people who get too close, and which also could be you, could also be civilians. And you say to yourself, who are those people and what are they doing here? Well, they could be escorting a businessman from point A to point B. They could be working for the U.S. government, guarding an embassy official. Or they could just be a member of the Iraqi government going to and from work. But all of a sudden you realize that they're usurping the provision of state-enforced laws and violence. And this is the problem. Yes, it's a good idea on paper if you have capability gaps and you want to hire qualified ex-military people to shore that up. But what happens when those people start realizing this is a business and the ethics and the morality fall away? And that's the thing I point out in my book over and over again.
We have some other callers here. Belgium, nearby community, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Good morning, sirs. Strange twist of fate that in the Revolutionary War, the Hessians were sent after us, who were the most hated of all the people that fought against the Revolutionary Army. And they were sent by a guy by the name George, too, weren't they? But that's another part of the story. It seems kind of strange the way it's twisted with us, because the fellows that were hung up on the bridge and burnt and brutalized in every way, weren't they just these sort of people?
Well, to be clear about the four men that were killed in Fallujah in March 2004, they were hired on to guard convoys that were delivering kitchen material. They were on their way to pick up some pots and pans, if you can believe it. They made a wrong turn. They went right through the middle of Fallujah, and they were killed instantly. That wasn't the story. The story was that the Marines around the area had a hands-off policy to Fallujah, which is a very violent city. George Bush saw what he saw on TV and said, flatten the place. And all of a sudden, that's when we injected the events of a civilian working in Iraq into our foreign policy. And Fallujah was flattened after that.
But still, they were mercenaries.
Well, no, a mercenary is someone who fights an offensive campaign in a foreign country under a foreign flag. These men were not there to kill people. They were there to guard a truck convoy. It's extremely mundane work. Now, if they had been engaged, which they were, yes, they would have fought back, and yes, they would have killed Iraqis, and they hopefully would have driven away quickly and got away from there. They wouldn't have stayed there and continued to battle. So there's a very discreet line between both those professions.
Yeah, it sounds kind of strange. The support people aren't called mercenaries, but the people who do the fighting are.
Yes, if we send a paramilitary in to train people to fight a war with a proxy army, yes, those are mercenaries. Like, you remember the Hnung mercenaries in Vietnam.
Yes.
They were trained by special forces teams and CIA. Were the CIA mercenaries? No. Were the special forces mercenaries? No. But the people we hired fought the war for us, and they were mercenaries.
Yeah. Kind of very subtle, very, very subtle little difference there, isn't there?
But it's a specific one that you'll see over and over again in the book, where the finger that goes on the trigger is always a local, whether it's an Afghan proxy. For example, there's a chapter about hunting bin Laden, and they hire Afghan mercenaries. And the actual contractors don't pull the trigger, but they direct and they train the Afghans to pull the trigger.
Thank you very much, sir.
My pleasure.
All right, let's go to another caller here. This is someone in Thomasboro, line 1. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Well, thank you very much. I was asked to join Blackwater many, many years ago because my expertise, and I declined because it's the cream of the crop of our paid assassins. Anything you want to get done, they will do it for money. I mean, the head of Blackwater offered the Department of Defense and Cheney said, do you want us to do this? We'll do any destabilization, murders, killings, anything you want to do. In military circles, intelligence circles, four guys that went in, they were going on an assassination mission and they got caught. That's what's always been known in military intel. The question is, how do we put Blackwater and the other groups back under total control, because they're literally out of control, not just in Iraq, but around the world?
Well, first of all, we don't even have the basics. We don't even know who these people are and what they're doing. The contracting system within the Department of Defense and State Department, sort of allows for people to work on our behalf without us knowing about it. But yet the companies are well identified. Secondly, one thing that you might find interesting is the companies are well known, but it's actually the business model is the actual contractor who are all independent contractors. In other words, it's like hire a maid type thing. Thirdly, Congress has asked for some kind of accountability and transparency, but in every case, there's been pushback where you don't want to know, you don't want to ask these questions. So it's up to the voters, it's up to the citizens to say, who are these people and what are they doing on our behalf?
I think it was so strange because you can get a temporary assignment over to Blackwater and the other groups while you're in the military or once you get out. Anyhow, it's just, I mean, they're the cream of the crop, you know, the paid assassins and mercenaries. And thank you very much. I mean, your talk today has been incredible.
All right, well, thanks for the call. We have maybe about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with writer, filmmaker, explorer Robert Young Pelton. He's written about this in his yet-to-be-published but soon-to-be-published book, License to Kill, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. For some reason, you seem to be, I don't want to make this sound negative, but you seem to be kind of attracted to these kinds of people in the sense that they interest you, you want to know more about them, you sort of want to know what they're about, and maybe that does have something to do with this attraction to dangerous places, maybe?
Well, I won't say that because I'm not of the same social ilk that many of the contractors are. I mean, I don't come from a rural southern background and I don't have any military experience. I'm interested in conflict and how it changes and how it morphs. And most of my time is spent trying to figure out what causes the conflict and how we can resolve it. One positive element of my time with mercenaries and with contractors and with various people that do this type of thing is that there is a movement to make it sort of a peacekeeping concept. In other words, what do you do with all these ex-military folks who want to contribute? But I also see a very negative thing in which it's sort of spiraling towards being sort of lockstepped with a failed foreign policy. So I'm advocating that more people learn about it, and that's why I wrote the book, that's why I'm doing the documentary for Explorer, because I want the voters to ask questions, and I want these companies to think, well, you know, we can use this for good, or we can still work in the shadows and do whatever we do. So I don't have an attraction for these people. I'm interested in how they affect the world at large in conflict.
Hmm. You touched on something, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about it, simply because it is something that there's been a lot of controversy and a lot of different people have been different things, and I'm curious about how much you know about it, and that is the circumstances under which Jean-Bertrand Aristide left Haiti the last time. He said that he was forced out by the United States, and I think the official position of the government has been no. No, we didn't do that. Of course they would say, no, we didn't do that. What do you know about that?
Okay, well, last month I was with the head of that detail in a place called Abu Ghraib, and I also interviewed people who are on the detail, and I go into great depths in the book explaining exactly what happened. Essentially, Aristide was a puppet. We put him in power, and we had to give him some type of defense or security where he just wouldn't be killed by the palace guard. So we gave him a Praetorian Guard made out of U.S. Ex-Special Forces and ex-military people. They were provided by a company called the Steele Foundation out of San Francisco. Their job was to keep him alive. As things deteriorated, he wanted to hire more of those people. And since he was paying for it, he was sent an order in to basically double his force. The State Department was losing interest in Aristide and said, no, you can't have these people because you're basically going to use them as mercenaries. The order went down, and a conversation was had with Steele Foundation, and they were told to wake him up and get him ready and take him to the airport on a specific time. I think it was early in the morning. His security detail came to him, said, we got to go, sir. They packed him up, and they drove him directly to the airport. There was a unmarked plane waiting for them with Americans in military uniform. The entire security detail and Aristide got on the plane with their families. The people who arrived on the plane changed out of their military airports. They landed in Miami. They told Aristide they were in some Caribbean country waiting for clearance. They found clearance in the Central African Republic, and then they flew over and dropped them off. One of the people on that detail working for the Steele Foundation got a phone call saying, hey, I've got another gig for you. Can you be at the airport within a couple hours? He said, sure. He went down there. He was then arrested about a few hours later for trying to overthrow the government of Equatorial Guinea. And that's what the linkages between what these people do is fascinating.
Hmm. Well, it's quite a story. And again, I want to tell people, if you want to read it, soon-to-be-published book, License to Kill, Hired Guns and the War on Terror, published by Crown, by our guest Robert Young Pelton. He's writer, filmmaker, explorer, has worked for CBS, ABC, National Geographic, is working on a documentary for National Geographic about this. You have some idea when that might be ready?
That'll come out probably in December or January, but if you go to my website, which is comebackalive.com, you can keep tabs on the book and what I'm doing.
All right. Well, Mr. Pelton, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. Again, Robert Young Pelton, A License to Kill is the book.